From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Michigan to visit a Ford plant today as he's threatened to withhold federal funding to that flood-ravaged state because it's legally sent out applications for mail-in ballots for voting in November.
Meanwhile, the latest numbers show 2.4 million people filed for unemployment last week, bringing the nine-week total to 38 million. That's more than 20% of the American workforce. And for the latest, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Tanya.
So 2.4 million new unemployment claims were filed last week. It's a leveling off of the weekly toll, but this is still sobering news, isn't it?
Yeah, what times we're in when 2.4 million feels better because it doesn't have a 3 in front of it or it doesn't have a 6 in front of it like prior weeks did. But it's remarkable. I mean, these are still historic numbers. And the thing that alarms me the most about this 2.4 is it comes in a week where a lot of states had started to open up. So there are a lot of people in America who in theory should be able to go back to work. So that's why this is more worrisome that it continues to grow. But it is expected that the unemployment ranks will continue to grow for a few months yet.
Yeah, people are going back to work, but then there are also some economists who are predicting about 40% of the jobs lost are not coming back. Is there any indication the economy will absorb these millions of positions that are lost?
Well, over time it tends to happen, but if you look at the last recession, it took a good 5 years to deal with what we call the overcapacity in the workforce, right? The extra people available versus the number of jobs that we've got. We were at a good pace of creating jobs before the pandemic hit, but that's been eliminated, and it'll be a while before we get back to that. So there's two pressures. One is there will be extra people and not jobs to match those people. And the second part is once you have extra people, it puts pressure, downward pressure on wages for those who do have jobs. And that, again, can take years to absorb.
For the unemployed, jobless benefits plus one stimulus check so far are the only way that many are getting by. But in thinking about companies, if they don't have cash or access to credit, they can't keep employees on or bring them back. Do you think the government should be doing more?
Well, there's a lot of criticism about the way the various plans to give businesses money have worked. Some have not been able to get money at all. Others look like companies that could have figured out other ways to pay for their staff or to keep things going. So there is definitely more. From a numerical standpoint, we're about half of what economists had thought that the government needs to provide for small businesses. But what we're finding is there's just stuff about the programs that aren't working right. And remember, a lot of these programs are to keep employees on for 2 or 3 months. We're now well into that. So definitely by September, that money will have run out. And if business isn't back to usual by then, we're not going to see more people hiring.
You referenced the last recession. Many people's lives have already drastically changed in the last 2.5 months. I mean, what do you think the quality of life is going to be after this pandemic? It's a big question, but it's one that we're all thinking about.
Yeah, and I think two things will happen. One is the human race is inherently resilient. If you look at all the big shocks of the past, including 9/11, including other pandemics, including the last recession, we do tend to bounce back. The question is, what will the changes look like? Does delivery to home become a bigger thing? Do we actually all space out at work? Do we do more online? Is delivery services a bigger growth area than professional services? So we'll get back to something that looks like a new normal. But the question is, how long does it take and what will it mean for the workforce? Remember, for all those people who aren't working, they're generally speaking not spending either. So if you can't figure out a way to get people an income, they don't contribute to the growth of the economy. That's why this thing, they'll be a normal, but we don't know whether that's a year away or 2 years away or 5 years away. That's the big question.
Yeah. History also shows us that economic upheaval like this can really spell doom for a sitting president's re-election bid. I mean, how do you see all of this playing out politically?
Yeah, well, there are new polls that show that this will negatively affect Donald Trump. And that's got very little to do with Donald Trump and more to do with the fact that when an economy turns bad, that is always an opportunity for people to look elsewhere for leadership. There are also criticisms in the same polls about the way Donald Trump has handled that. So that's going to hurt him as well. But there's no way to turn an economy around this quickly in the months that we've got before an election. So the latest numbers indicate that the traditional thinking about a bad economy hurting a sitting president are actually affecting Donald Trump right now.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. As always, thank you, Ali.
My pleasure.
Let's check in now in Bangladesh. Yesterday, a cyclone tore through both Bangladesh and India, both in lockdown because of COVID-19. And in Cox's Bazar, a city in southeast Bangladesh, more than a million Rohingya refugees who fled Myanmar are encamped. They've confirmed their first cases of COVID-19 and now a cyclone. Deepankar Datta is the Bangladesh country director for Oxfam. Deepankar, I know you're speaking to us on Skype using mobile data because you have no electricity, no Wi-Fi, so thank you. And how bad was this cyclone, especially in the middle of the Rohingya encampment in Cox's Bazar?
So here, actually, in Bangladesh, we are facing crisis on top of crisis. So we have the Rohingya refugees, then COVID-19, economic meltdown, and on top of it, the cyclone Amphan. Around 10 million people are affected in the coastal parts of Bangladesh. Millions of hectares of land is underwater. Many houses, makeshift houses blown away. And the pictures that we are seeing is heartbreaking. In Cox's Bazar, you know, we are fortunate that the heat was not that devastating. But definitely we are receiving the reports of landslides in the Rohingya camps. We are hearing the news of floods. The communication is almost broken in many parts of Bangladesh. So the information is reaching to us pretty slowly, but we are on top of it.
Well, a couple things. We know that there wasn't as much loss of life as there might have been. We know after that horrible 1999 cyclone, there were changes made. There were cement shelters built, and officials there are being congratulated on really getting out and telling people to evacuate ahead of the cyclone. But of course, you know, in a refugee camp, they can't evacuate. And we've seen pictures of people even outside the refugee camp just jam-packed together in these shelters, so certainly no social distancing. What are your concerns about the Rohingya refugees in particular? You know, hard times before a cyclone, now probably jammed together even more without as much housing, without as much shelter, and with a case of COVID-19.
It is a very, very serious concern. You know, like in camp, in a per square kilometer area, 40,000 people live, and in some cases, it is up to 70,000. So physical distancing often, it's simply not possible. So we are working on a number of fronts to mitigate the crisis. You know, the COVID cases has already been detected. Around 10 people are already infected there. So what we are doing, we are promoting innovative tools, like, for example, contactless hand washing stations in the camp, encouraging religious leaders to stay home and not to go to the mosque for the prayers. We have the innovative tools and techniques, but to scale it up, we need resources. Like at this point of time, we need $3 million only for the refugee camps. Now, every day, only 10 Rohingyas goes through the COVID-19 test. Just think about, in a 1 million population, 10 tests are nothing.
Am I hearing, by the way, you're saying you need to increase the testing capacity, you need so much, and you're turning around and looking at a world that's also dealing with a pandemic and maybe not paying as much attention to you after a cyclone, but am I hearing prayers behind you?
Yeah, this is the month of Ramadan, you know, the holy month. Eid is only a few days away. And just look at the unfortunate event that we are facing now with so many crises, and the festivity has disappeared completely.
And on top of that, we have to add that your organization, Oxfam, is going to lay off almost 1,500 employees and stop operations in 18 countries because of how the pandemic is affecting your finances. Do you worry about Oxfam going forward? And do you worry about Oxfam in Bangladesh with all the needs there?
it is sad, you know, like the COVID-19 has impacted the organizations. But as we have been saying, that the COVID crisis, it's a global crisis. Rohingya refugee crisis, it's a global crisis. And the nations, developed nations, need to come forward, need to move forward. Oxfam has a history to provide the best services in the refugee camps, to stand beside the most vulnerable and destitute. So we do need support from various actors across the globe to keep up the good work that we are doing. But definitely, it is a very sad news for us. Our hugs to all the staff members of those 18 countries. Mm-hmm. They have a long history, good work that they have done over the last many, many years.
Yeah. Deepankar Datta, Bangladesh Country Director for Oxfam, on the cyclone there, the refugee camp status, COVID-19, and the financial problems for Oxfam. Just so much going on. Deepankar, we wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you again. Thank you for inviting me.
Where are we in the pandemic? Well, today the WHO announced the highest daily number of new COVID-19 cases, 106,000. California also had its highest daily rate. 14 states in the U.S. are showing rising numbers, although at least 15 are seeing a decline. There's still no cure or prevention. Nope, absolutely no evidence that hydroxychloroquine does either. But there have been small advances in finding a vaccine, and a study showed antibodies may ward off future infections. Still, last night, CDC Director Robert Redfield warned of another spike in the fall or winter. CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta wrote in an essay, "If America was his patient, we'd be having a tough conversation, and both patient and doctor would have to keep up their end of the deal." He's here to once again answer our questions. Dr. Gupta, Sanjay, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And start with the rising cases, because people might say, oh, that's just because we have more testing, so we know more. Your thoughts?
I think testing and the increased numbers of testing are certainly going to fuel the increased number of cases, but not entirely, Robin. I think what we're seeing here is actually more people also becoming infected. And we're also reminded that this is a snapshot in time from probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, between the time people are exposed to the time that they get tested, the time they may develop symptoms, if they're going to develop symptoms. There's a lag time.
Yeah, cautionary there. So how do we fight it? Let's talk about antibodies. That research that showed that monkeys who were infected with the coronavirus and developed antibodies after disease seemed to later be protected against reinfection. So let's get to some questions. Listener Ellen Dibble asks, will antibodies protect people? And if so, should we bank blood with antibodies so we can share it? On the other hand, listener Jane S. reminds us of those sailors on the Roosevelt who were sick, tested negative several times after being sick, but then they got COVID-19 again. So where are we on antibodies?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating time. I mean, I will go out on a limb and say that as a general rule, when people become infected and then they recover, they should have antibodies in their blood, and that antibodies should provide some level of protection. What we don't know is how long or how strong that protection is. So if you take the situation of the USS Roosevelt and those sailors, were the tests, which, you know, sometimes have a high rate of false negatives, as we know, showing a negative result when in fact they were positive. Sometimes when people test positive again, it's not necessarily that they have active virus. It just could be remnants of virus. We don't know for sure. But I think we should not deviate from what we've known scientifically for some time, that there should be some level of protection. We just don't know how long or how strong. Now, one point I think is very fundamental is that when you look at a vaccine trial, in addition to looking for antibodies, you're also looking for efficacy. That's a principle called neutralizing antibodies. And what we've shown now in some of these trials very early is that there's evidence of neutralizing antibody effect. That's significant. We haven't even found that after 40 years with HIV vaccines.
Well, let's talk about those trials. Moderna, for instance, announced that their vaccine did successfully trick 8 of the volunteers into developing antibodies. But when you say it's very early, we wouldn't be talking about something like this. you know, there has been concern that that wasn't peer reviewed, only 8 subjects. So it sounds like you are a little excited about what they're doing, but maybe with some caution.
I think that's a good way of putting it. And there's 2 things. One is that had it not shown antibodies, that would have been definitive, right? We would have known that it didn't work. As we've said with HIV vaccine trials for 40 years, didn't work. Mm. Here now you at least have proof of concept. Is it going to work in larger groups of people? These are young, healthy people for the most part. Will it work in older people? Will it last that long? In essence, this is still a chance that even if it works scientifically, it may not work practically in the population.
Talk about who gets it, meaning COVID-19. We heard today about the study indicating that children may be less likely to get COVID-19. We know they get, you know, a horrible other side effect disease, you know, down the road after being infected, but they are less likely to get COVID-19. And it may be because they have fewer receptors in the cells in their noses. But do we know why some adults get it, others don't? Why some young people without any vulnerabilities have those, you know, cytokine storms? They fight it off so much that they die and others don't?
I think we're starting to learn more. You know, normally when we talk, I'm telling you based on 10 years of data, Robin, we can't even say that in the number of weeks yet. But I will say this, I've spent a lot of time looking at the various routes of entry, if you will, of this virus into the human body. And the study that came out looking at what's called the ACE2 receptors said basically there's fewer of those in children as compared to adults. That's one route of entry. We do know that kids, even if they're not getting sick, can still be harboring the virus and still spread the virus. It's a concerning point because it's going to dictate a lot of policy with regard to schools and things like that in the fall. When people get very sick and if they die, it can really be for a few different reasons. In people with weakened immune systems, it can be that the virus just was able to replicate unchecked and eventually overwhelm the body. In people who are otherwise healthy, it could be that their body is sort of overreacting to the virus. Think of it almost like an anaphylactic reaction with an allergy. And in that case, it's the inflammation itself, the cytokine storm, that basically is causing people to get very sick and die.
Look, we had that report today, that stunning report from Columbia University that concluded that if the U.S. had started social distancing just a week earlier, 36,000 lives could have been saved. 2 weeks earlier would have saved 54,000. There's going to be plenty of looking back. I want now for you to look forward, taking that information in as states opening up. Your thoughts?
That does also assume that as states locked down earlier, that people would have been on board. You remember in the early days, people were hearing about this, but I think in the early days, people really weren't taking it very seriously. And I think it wasn't until the NBA announced they were suspending the season that a lot of people
in the middle of the game.
Yeah. Right. What's happening here? What is this? What is this virus all about? But there's 2 points, really. One is that we're not through with this pandemic, unfortunately, and I hate saying it, like you. Come fall, we may be sort of looking at some of these same decision matrices again. Are we going to do it early enough? I think that people should remember the study coming out of Columbia and Jeffrey Shaman's work at that time, because I think it's going to be important to not lose that lesson. Do remember that South Korea, which is admittedly a much smaller country, 1/6, 1/7 the population of the United States, had their first patient diagnosed on the same day as we had our first patient diagnosed in the United States. Their total number of infected is around 11,000, and total number of people who have died is under 300. Not under 3,000, under 300. Why? Because they acted early. They tested with an existing test, the World Health Organization test, which we had access to as well, and they didn't implement some of these movement restrictions as well early. It can be done, and we should keep that lesson in mind because we may be dealing with this for some time to come.
Speaking of testing, we've had listeners ask, why test if, in fact, you could be tested negative and then, you know, on the way home, get infected? Just briefly, what's the importance of the testing?
I think if you find somebody who's positive, that's really going to be the key, because then you can isolate that person and decrease the likelihood that what is a small cluster of people who may be becoming infected doesn't become a huge cluster and turn into exponential growth.
Is there a safe way to go to a gym or a salon?
I think there is a safer way. I mean, there is a virus circulating, Rob, and it's a contagious virus. I mean, that hasn't changed. CDC, thankfully, has now their 60-page of guidelines. You're going to have to approach it differently than in the past, as everyone knows. Be prepared. Don't blow this off and read those guidelines.
Plexiglass between customers. Make sure you're watching people wipe the surfaces all the time. Stay 6 feet away. Still wear masks. I mean, bottom line, it's still true that it's the virus is spread from droplets from speech that either falls on surfaces or hangs in the air.
That's right. It seems to be primarily person-to-person contact. So it's a distance, but it's also duration. You'd be 6 feet away from somebody for 2 hours. That's worse than being 6 feet away from someone for 5 minutes. There's also the type of activity that's going on. So there's lots of different considerations. I like the way Tom Frieden put it. We should get to the point where you have to decide, are you going to take an umbrella to work that day or not, based on all the various data that you can take in.
And just very briefly, Sanjay, there are people who are crushed by what this is doing to their livelihoods. And in some parts of the country, they also can't see this virus the way some cities can. Could you just talk for a second to the people who are genuinely, heartbroken? They're not as worried about their lives because their lives are attached to their livelihoods.
This is an awful situation. As a doctor, I'm operating all weekend in the hospital, and I take care of patients who suddenly find out they have a medical problem that's significant, and it's the only thing in their lives they can think about. I mean, we're dealing with this as a world right now. We are going to get through it. It's going to take time. It's just very hard to say, hey, look, I don't want to go through the treatment. I just want to get better. That's just not the way that it works. We can't abandon treatment partway through and then get upset that we're not getting better. What I would say is that right now, the idea of how we behave is not only a potential risk for ourselves, but for the people that we love. I think about it every time I come home from the hospital. Do I have the virus? Could I potentially be infecting my three little girls? That is just the time period in which we live. We will get through it. We've seen countries get through it. It's like saying, I got patients who have gotten through the therapy. Let me introduce you to these patients. It might make you feel better. Not right this second, but at least you see the light at the end of the tunnel. We'll get there. We just got to make sure we do it right.
Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime, Adam. Thank you.
The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, is expecting more travelers this Memorial Day weekend, though nothing close to the numbers before the coronavirus outbreak. And new screening measures may soon be in place, including taking your temperature to help stop the spread of the virus. The Trump administration and airlines support the measures, but as NPR's David Shaper reports, public health experts are not happy about them.
You know the drill. You take out your laptop, take off your shoes, and put whatever else you're carrying into the bins and down the conveyor belt to be x-rayed. Then your body is scanned, too. And soon, a TSA officer might also point a thermal device at your forehead to take your temperature. And if you have a fever, you could be banned from flying.
Our top priority is to restart this industry safely.
Alexandre Dejuniac heads the International Air Transport Association, and in a recent conference call, he detailed a multi-layered biosecurity plan aimed at reassuring potential travelers. That plan includes requiring face masks on board, physical distancing when lining up to get on and off the plane, limiting passenger movement during the flight, and taking travelers' temperatures before they board.
This system will prevent the circulation of the virus and the contamination on board.
In the U.S., the major airlines are lobbying to have the TSA do that thermal screening, but some in Congress don't think the agency has the legal authority to do so. Attorney Jonathan Meyer disagrees.
TSA is in charge of a lot more than just stopping terrorism.
Meyer is a former deputy general counsel in the Department of Homeland Security.
It is TSA's job, in large part, to protect the lives, health, and welfare of passengers.
And Meyer says that job includes protecting travelers from biological threats. And he says it's better than having the airlines doing it at the gate.
That seems a lot more cumbersome than using an already existing single point of entrance where screening is already taking place.
And Meyer contends that a no-touch thermal scan is no more intrusive than what the TSA already does. But Jay Stanley of the ACLU disagrees.
It isn't anybody's business normally what my temperature is. It's not the biggest invasion of privacy, but it's a physiological reading about my body. And lurking behind and alongside temperature readings are other physiological readings, which will increasingly be able to be performed remotely without your knowledge, let alone permission.
And would temperature scanning really help halt the spread of the virus?
The reality is this, the data that we have is that these temperature checks just do not pick up many cases.
Dr. Abrar Karan at the Harvard Medical School says checking travelers for fevers won't catch those who are asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, but who can still transmit the virus. He points to a study showing that only 30% of COVID-19 patients had fevers when admitted to New York City hospitals.
So they may develop fever later on, but they may not have it initially. And actually, you know that initially is when your viral load is highest, right? When your symptoms are just about starting is when your viral load in the upper respiratory tract is peaking.
Karan and others worry that airport temperature scans could provide a false sense of security, actually leading to more transmissions of the coronavirus. In a statement, the TSA says at this time no decision has been made regarding specific health screening measures at airports, adding that the agency is working with the airlines, the CDC, and other agencies to decide on the best course of action. There are reports, though, that the White House and CDC officials have clashed on the matter, and the Trump administration could order the TSA to begin temperature scanning over the CDC's objections. David Shaper, NPR News.
New polling this week shows that Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic Party presidential nominee, has an 11-point national lead over President Trump. And in a recent Washington Post opinion piece, some high-profile black women are telling Biden, in no uncertain terms, that you owe it to black voters and America to choose a black woman as a running mate. Angela Rye is one of the co-writers of that op-ed piece. She's a Democratic political strategist and frequent roundtable guest over the years at Here and Now. Hi, Angela.
Thank you, Tanya. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so we know that Biden jumped to the front of the line and became the presumptive nominee after the South Carolina primary, where black people overwhelmingly voted for him. And really, black women in particular were on the ground leading the effort to mobilize voters. You contend that Biden can't take this support for granted, and he needs to choose a black woman as VP. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, first we had three demands overall. We're definitely not the first group of black women that came to the campaign with this firm suggestion. I think the important thing for us is to take that argument a step further and say, in addition to the black woman VP running mate, we're telling you that you need to commit, because he suggested during a Democratic primary debate in South Carolina that he would pick a black woman Supreme Court justice. We gave him reasons why that commitment must be met. And then we also, and I think, Tanya, frankly, this is the most important part, we say that you need a comprehensive black agenda. Joe Biden's campaign rolled out a plan for black America called Lift Every Voice, which was lackluster and falls short of what is really required to mobilize voters in November. And what you're seeing right now is a slight decline in his support from black people in a Quinnipiac poll that was released yesterday, which has him at about 81% among black voters. And some people would say, well, he's killing it. Sure, but you have to understand how many black voters you need to actually turn out. It actually needs to be over 85%. It probably should be closer into the 90s and really should be at 2008 Obama levels.
I want to talk with you more about what would infuse that support, but I want to also ask you about some of the folks that are being talked about as potential VP running mates. So recent polls have shown that Biden is leading in Michigan, which Trump won by less than 1% back in 2016. And we've been hearing a lot about Governor Gretchen Whitmer. She actually said this week that she's talked with Biden campaign officials about the vice presidency. The argument here is that Biden needs to pick Whitmer because he has to win Michigan back. But your piece actually says by virtue of who Biden is, he already has what is considered white working class specifically. Can you explain more about what you mean?
Biden's appeal has always been to the Democratic Party that finds itself forever courting white voters who have left the party for 40 plus years. This blue collar white voter, that is supposed to be his primary appeal. So if this Democratic Party that says it is a big tent party cares about its most loyal base, it seems to me that you would not want to estrange the loyal, reliable voting blocks.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the other contenders up for the VP position. There's a thinking that Biden may want to pick someone with experience, in part because he's older and he may actually not run again after this cycle. Some, like Elizabeth Warren, another white woman with a national profile, is someone that folks are hailing up. What if Biden picks her? And thinking specifically about the need to galvanize Black voters above this 81% threshold that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, our piece says Black, and I think the reality of it is that's what we meant. I will tell you that I was disappointed that I couldn't vote for Elizabeth Warren because she dropped out before I turned in my Washington State ballot, right? And I will also say that she had, if not the most comprehensive, one of the most comprehensive Black agendas in the primary. For whatever reason, that did not shore up a large amount of Black support. I don't think that Elizabeth Warren is the same as Gretchen Whitmer or the same as Amy Klobuchar, right? Which is where we're really hearing a lot of buzz. I haven't heard a whole lot of buzz around Elizabeth Warren from writers and pundits, yes, but I haven't heard that from the campaign very much.
Well, let's talk about Black. We're talking about former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. She's one of the Black women who is right up at the front campaigning for this job, which has really garnered some criticism because there's this idea that VP hopefuls don't actively campaign for this position. She did a joint interview with Biden on MSNBC last week and spoke about voter suppression. Let's listen.
What we know about voter suppression is that it works best when people don't vote, when people are pushed out of the process because they're afraid to vote or they think it won't work. The way to overcome voter misinformation, Russian interference, is to overwhelm the polls with our presence. We have to vote in numbers we have not seen before.
I mean, Angela, this is a lot of what you're saying. But as a former state lawmaker, she doesn't have a long political resume. Biden has said he's looking for someone who is, quote, simpatico, who agrees strategically with him and is ready to be president at a moment's notice. Does Abrams fit that bill?
I think first we have to break down what simpatico means. I've been hearing that term thrown around quite a bit by Joe Biden and his team. And so is it about making Joe Biden comfortable? Is it about what people deem as appropriate political experience? It's actually ridiculous that Stacey Abrams' experience has been questioned so much. If it weren't for voters being purged off of rolls in Georgia by the then Secretary of State, now governor of Georgia, to his advantage, Stacey Abrams would be the governor of Georgia. So even the folks who have frowned upon the way that she's gone about this, they frowned upon a lot of the actions she took to mobilize people to the polls in Georgia. And so I think the reality of this is a new day and age where people who are voluntarily and willingly going to vote for Joe Biden, regardless of who he picks, regardless of what he does, is a different group and a smaller group than what is needed truly from this party. And so they're going to have to engage people who move similarly to them and not just in alignment with the typical party establishment.
Other women on the list, Florida Congresswoman and former Orlando Police Chief Val Demings, who was an impeachment manager in the Senate earlier this year, and also California Senator Kamala Harris, who criticized Biden in a debate last summer, as we all remember, for opposing court-ordered busing to desegregate schools. These are also two women that have come up often as possible VP contenders. What do you think their chances are?
Senator Kamala Harris talking to Joe Biden about his record on a debate stage is fair game. And for whatever reason, her challenge of his position with the crime bill and the other bills that he authored and led their passage through the Senate, and as well as the busing segregation issue, has for whatever reason ginned up a lot of frustration in the campaign. And so if the challenge alone from someone who is our first Black senator in California, who was the first Black state attorney general and has a number of other accomplishments, can't challenge the future leader of the party. I think that we have some bigger challenges, and I think that we're not poised to win. When it comes to Congresswoman Val Demings, she is tremendous. Of course, winning Florida should be a very important goal of the Democratic Party as well. But more than anything else, I want to be really clear about the fact that there are three demands that we have, and we are suggesting very firmly that folks fall in line with these demands, because if they do not, it's going to be very difficult to mobilize first-time Black voters, voters who are on the fringe, voters who can't, whose candidate was not selected in the primary, and folks who just have no interest in Joe Biden, particularly, Tanya, when we're dealing with the greatest crisis in modern history with this pandemic.
With COVID-19.
You're asking people to do a whole lot.
Angela Rye is a Democratic political strategist. Angela, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
So have you scrolled through Room Raider yet? That's the Twitter feed that rates the background decor of every guest on every show, sometimes with an aside. Creator Claude Taylor is the founder of the left-wing Mad Dog Pack. Let's just say he's not a fan of Representative Steve King, the Republican from Iowa known for racist remarks. And Taylor also said NBC's Dylan Byers looked like he was in a hostage video. But he swooned over CNN's Simone Sanders' black and white vase that matched her black and white striped shirt. It was magnificent. Claude Taylor's Room Raider Twitter feed has over 193,000 followers. He scores the backgrounds and interviewees on a scale of 1 to 10, with help from his girlfriend Jessie Barre, who lives in Canada. And Claude Taylor joins us from his home in Washington, D.C. by Skype. So we can't see him. And Claude, whoo boy, glad you can't see me. But how did you guys decide to do this in the first place?
You know, we're both watching cable news and we're both making comments about whoever we're seeing. And sometimes we're paying more attention to the backgrounds than we are to what they are saying. And so we just started rating them sort of informally between ourselves. And then it was a very quick step to, like, let's set up a Twitter account and let's start putting out these ratings. And honestly, let's just try to have some fun with it.
You know, everybody else was thinking of it. You did it. And you don't hold back. I mean, you really give advice to Wall Street Journal reporter Tim Higgins. You write, adjust plant placement, would prefer more colorful art. My hair's doing the same thing. And I mentioned the hostage situation that you sometimes compare pictures to. Cory Booker's review comes to mind. And then there was Beto O'Rourke, your comment, oh, dear God, organizing rescue mission. Blink twice if you can hear me.
It was very upsetting. I mean, a lot of people were really worried for him. I mean, he was stuck in the basement. There was like a big pipe next to his head. You know, it could have been serious.
Are you doing the hearings? I scrolled through. I didn't see one. But, the recent Senate hearing testimony of Anthony Fauci, you had the Republican Senator Lamar Alexander's dog.
We like the dog. Let me put it that way. I mean, we are bipartisan and we like Republican dogs. We can't help it.
And what about Fauci?
Fauci has the room and is the most respected infectious disease expert in the country. Like, can you, until this happened, who could name more than one? He would be the one. And he also has a great room. It's a little disheveled. He's got a little bit of the absent-minded professor going on, a couple issues with some stacks of books. It just proves he's actually reading. So, you know, he's got a terrific room.
Well, and people you note seem to go out and get help or do something after they get a low rating from you.
Well, that's what's really fun. A lot of people have gone out and they bought the flowers. Al Roker, he had a very nice room, but there were a couple issues with it. He addressed that concern and said he would take it under advisement and came back the next day having addressed my concerns and having just completely blown away the lighting, the aesthetics, the decor. He got every bit of it. He got a 10 out of 10, which is rare. So, you know, I mean, when people work with us, we work with them. I haven't heard back from Ted Cruz, though.
Well, full disclosure, I love the advice you gave to an up-and-coming reporter for the New York Times, who happens to be my nephew, hasn't thought about his wall art ever. and a chair that was sticking out. And he was also not looking right at the camera. So it's not about just what's behind you. You also give the helpful advice, raise your computer up so you're looking right into it. It's at eye level. You're not looking off, you know, to the right-hand side of the screen when someone's talking to you.
Sometimes all you really need to do is move the camera and go from, say, a 5 to a 7. Prince William, you know, is looking down at the camera and we're looking at his crown molding. There may have been some wonderful art on the wall. We had no way of knowing because we were looking at his ceiling.
Real quick, there's a bookstore in Boston, the Brattle Bookstore, and they're being called on to take pictures of some of these incredible book collections they have so that people can superimpose them on the background of their Zoom shots.
Well, you know, you don't have to use books, but if you're going to use books, use real books. And that means books that you've read. Avoid decorator tips like organizing books by color. That's not something readers do. So when we see color-coded books, that's a 3-point automatic deduction.
How about awards? Would you caution people against? I mean, I remember in one comment you said, hey, where's your Emmy?
Look, if I had an Emmy, you know, damn right, I'd have it behind me on the bookshelf. I think you can overdo it. A lot of times we also have sort of the DC variant of that, which is what we call, you know, the ego wall or the vanity wall. And that's where you have your photo with every president you worked for and the ambassador and the senator and all of those pictures behind you. And you know what? None of us care. I mean, put some art up there. Put a plant next to you. Add a lamp. Make it a more pleasing atmosphere. But, you know, let's like...
Rent a dog.
Rent a dog. That's actually happened. There's actually been cases where, in Italy in particular, with the lockdown, people were renting out their dogs because you were allowed to leave the apartment for 30 minutes, but only if you had a dog. It's the same idea.
Claude Taylor, his viral Twitter site is Room Raider, puts it together with his girlfriend. They rate people's Skype backgrounds when they appear on television. We'll link it here and now.org. Claude, thank you. And again, I'm so glad I'm not in video. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, we've got some of his tweets at herenow.org. Beto O'Rourke, are you okay? Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.